Oh, yeah.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is April 23rd, 2015. First item on the agenda is a public hearing, possible work session on House Bill, Senate Bill 189.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 189 comes to you from the Senate Judiciary Committee, and it had a floor vote of 29-1. Senate Bill 189 deals with state agencies and confidentiality of mediation discussions. Now, mediation is a method that some state agencies use to resolve internal disputes, and if they want to keep the content of those mediation sessions confidential, they must adopt rules that are made by the Attorney General. They are not allowed to amend the rules. However, they still have to go through the lengthy rulemaking process. Senate Bill 189 provides a streamlined process for agencies to adopt those model mediation confidentiality rules that are already developed by the Attorney General.
Thank you. Amy Alpa.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Amy Alpa, and I'm a senior assistant attorney general in the chief counsel's office at the Department of Justice, and I frequently advise on administrative law issues. So what Senate Bill 189 does is very simple. It changes the process that state agencies use to adopt mediation confidentiality rules. State agency mediation communications are not confidential unless they adopt rules developed by the Attorney General, but under current law, the Attorney General doesn't have to go through any formal public notice and comment rulemaking when we develop the rules, but each state agency that adopts the rules has got to go through that formal rulemaking process. So essentially, the current process invites the public in after the rules have already been developed and imposes an administrative burden on state agencies for no good purpose. So Senate Bill 189 shifts the formal rulemaking requirement to the Attorney General when we're developing the rules and relieves state agencies of having to go through formal rulemaking when they simply want to adopt those rules. Instead, they would adopt them by reference, which is what they do when adopting other Attorney General model rules. And we reached out to the Oregon Mediation Association and also to the Alternative Dispute Resolution section of the bar. They both support the bill. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hope we don't have an assistant today.
Do you need help?
Yeah, you want to be my assistant today and move things. Move to a work session on House Bill 189.
Who are you talking to?
Governor Springer.
Please, Sherry. Oh, you just.
Sorry, bad joke, sorry.
What are you? Some motions?
Yes, okay. So here he comes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move that we pass Senate Bill 189 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Springer moves Senate Bill. I have trouble saying that. 189 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Post will carry. Open a public hearing on House Bill. Senate Bill 367.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 367 came out of your Judiciary Committee with a unanimous vote and unanimous vote across the floor. This comes to you from the Oregon State Bar Consumer Law Section. This deals with property after it's gone through a foreclosure sale. After a foreclosure execution sale, the buyer gets a certificate for a period of 180 days, approximately 6 months. During that time, the certificate holder can use and enjoy the property and has all of the rights as if they held the deed. However, they do not have the deed until the end of that period because the former owner has a right to redeem the property. If the property that is sold is part of a condo complex or a homeowners association, there are still fees that are due, and there has been some confusion as to who is responsible for paying those fees. Senate Bill 367 puts in statute that it is the certificate holder, the person who has purchased the condo or house, who is responsible for paying the homeowner fees during that period of time.
Okay, thank you. Call.
May I ask you a question?
Yes.
Does that pertain to past fees that are due from the prior owner as well?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, I believe it only applies to fees after the execution sale.
Currently accruing fees.
Correct.
Kelly Harpster and Greg Coxey, please. Please go ahead and just state your name for the record.
Yeah, Kelly Harpster.
Greg Coxey.
Either one, go ahead.
Sure. Go ahead. Okay, well, good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Harpster. I'm an attorney in private practice in Lake Oswego, and I'm here today on behalf of the Consumer Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. The Consumer Law Section represents about 200 attorneys all across the state who work with consumers who have issues ranging from foreclosure, debt collection, disputes over consumer goods and services, that sort of thing. And we're here today in support of Senate Bill 367. The bill actually just fixes a narrow problem. It really is more of a clarification to existing law. It says who is liable for condo and homeowner association dues or assessments during the redemption period after judicial foreclosure. And the only reason it might cause anybody confusion now is both the HOA and the condo statute say, as you would expect them to, that the owner is liable for those assessments. And we do something a little weird in Oregon during the redemption period after judicial foreclosure. We split legal title from equitable ownership. So the statute says that bare legal title remains in the judgment debtor, the person who got foreclosed. But all of the other sticks in the bundle of property rights, equitable ownership, passes to the purchaser at sale. So the right to use and occupy the property, the right to rent it out, the right to enjoy the benefits of the HOA and the condo association. So sometimes it gets a little confusing for consumers who tend to go to general practitioners who don't have expertise. They may get confused. They go to bankruptcy attorneys. They talk to realtors and others. And if you read the statute, it's very confusing for the average person about how it works. But in fact, and it sounds like you probably hear this, with the HOAs and the banks, most of these properties go back to the banks. They do the same thing they do in every state. The equitable owner is responsible to pay those fees, and they do. But this clarifies it so there's no question about how it works under the law. So all the bill really does is it says that the purchaser at sale is solely liable for the HOA condo assessments during the redemption period. And then it also provides, again, to make it clear that if the judgment debtor or somebody else redeems the property, it goes back, part of the redemption amount they have to pay is to reimburse any of those assessments that were made during the redemption period.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, and committee, my name is Greg Coxey. I'm a lawyer with the law firm of Vile Fotheringham. We represent hundreds of associations through Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Utah, Arizona. And I'm here also representing an ad hoc a working group, as well as the Community Association Institute, Legislative Action Committee, and the Legislative Committee of the Oregon-Washington Community Association of Managers. We are in support of this bill. As was previously stated, this just adds a clarification. In practice, the assessments have been or should have been paid by the foreclosing entity, which in most cases is the bank. So we're here in support of this bill.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Any questions?
Yeah, I want to just clarify what you just said. My assumption is that when a property is sold in these circumstances, there are liens on it, there are old homeowners association dues that haven't been paid for a while, which may be a lien. That's all paid out of the proceeds of the sale. The person who now, the certificate owner, doesn't pay those prior assessments, only assessments after that person took over. Is that?
That is correct. The owner who gets foreclosed on is responsible for all of the past association assessments, late fees, interest, and everything like that. So we're not asking the bank to pay all of those assessments just from the time that they take title.
Okay. Hey, thank you. Any questions, committee? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Open a work session on Senate Bill 367A.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 367 to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 367 to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you.
Open a public hearing House bill on Senate Bill 375.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 375 passed out of your Judiciary Committee with a unanimous vote and a unanimous vote across the Senate floor. This comes to you from the Oregon Judicial Department, and it allows the use of declarations under penalty of perjury in certain court processes.
Okay. Josh Nasby, please.
Good afternoon. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Josh Nasby. I'm with the Oregon Judicial Department. Senate Bill 375 does one thing in five areas of the law. It allows litigants to use a declaration under penalty of perjury as an alternative to an affidavit. And these documents, a declaration is the functional equivalent of an affidavit with one exception, and that is it can be self-executed. There's no need to visit a notary as long as you sign your name under the declaration under penalty of perjury. It's the functional equivalent. And the bill identifies five areas of the law where two things are true. These are areas of the law where we see a lot of self-represented litigants navigating the court system without an attorney. And not coincidentally, these are areas of the law where we create forms these litigants can use and file with the court. The five areas are small claims proceedings, so we're talking civil suits involving smaller dollar amounts, written testimony and violation proceedings. Under current law, if you were to get a traffic ticket today and you had to work, you're allowed to provide the court with written testimony, and so we're allowing a declaration in that instance. Divorce and child custody proceedings, juvenile guardianship reports, and for context, when a person's appointed guardian, they have to submit an annual report to the court providing information on what's happened in the last year. On the probate side, current law authorizes a declaration under penalty of perjury. This brings the juvenile guardianship statute in conformity. In the fifth area of the law are restraining order proceedings. So the three proceedings amended by the bill are Family Abuse Prevention Act, the Elderly Persons and Persons with a Disability Prevention Act, and the Sexual Assault Protective Orders. The bill amends these statutes to allow the initial petition, the renewal petition, and the proof of service to be filed with the declaration. What the bill does not do is, under current law, there's a process for the protected person to come into court and ask the court to dismiss the restraining order, and in that context, we retain the affidavit requirement. So at bottom, we think this is a court access bill. It removes a barrier of having to visit a notary and, in some cases, an expense of having to pay the notary for litigants to access the court. And we're particularly excited about the implications for e-court, where the declaration will allow for sort of one-stop filing, as opposed to under current law, you would have to print out your form, visit a notary, come home, scan it, and then e-file it. If Senate Bill 375 becomes law, we can update those forms so that they can be e-filed directly. And so with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may
have. Are there any questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Josh, following up on a discussion we had in my office, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it was ORCP 1ED, something like that, provides that a declaration can be used as a substitute for an affidavit, i.e. that they're equivalent. I gather then that the rules of civil procedure do not apply to the five kinds of action in this statute. I honestly don't know.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, it's a good question. We actually had an internal debate about the extent or the scope of ORCP 1E. I think but the legislative history and the text of the rule suggest that it applies when the rules themselves require an affidavit. In that circumstance, you're allowed to substitute. Mm-hmm. I don't believe it has sort of the broader implication across all statutes.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 375.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 375 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 375 to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Springer, please.
Yes.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 376.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 376 came out of committee with a unanimous vote and across the Senate floor with a unanimous vote as well. This is the Oregon Judicial Department's 2015 Court Operations Bill. It eliminates the requirement that a petitioner supply three copies of a petition for post-conviction relief. It allows the Chief Justice to adopt rules allowing evidence in post-conviction relief cases to be attached electronically. It sets a default year term for the courts that can be changed to suit the needs of individual districts. It aligns the guardian's report required under the juvenile code with the guardian's report required under the probate code, and eliminates the statutory form of the Elder Person and Persons with Disability Abuse Prevention Act.
Thank you. Mr. Miller.
Thank Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel to the state court administrator. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department. Thank you for taking the time to hear this bill. You know, we really love the big projects where we're trying to get efficiencies like Oregon E-Corp, but we try to keep our eye on the little things where we can also get some efficiencies. You know, we get about 50 million pages filed a year with us. Every little thing that we can do to make the process go better helps. And so we take ideas submitted from our staff, our judges, and our business partners, and each odd year session we come up with a bill like this with some small potatoes, but they help us a lot. I could take you through each one of these, but the committee counsel has already described everything that the bill does. The only thing that I would add is on the abuse forms. We currently have a couple of the forms that are not in statute. For instance, the Family Law, the Family Abuse Prevention Act, and a couple others. We work on those with our business partners outside of statute. And what we're doing with that section of the bill is we're taking these other forms out so that they can be worked as a group with the FAPA and the SAPL and those things. And if you look on OLIS, you'll see that Sybil Hebb submitted a letter in support on the House side. The Oregon Law Center is one of our partners in creating these forms and keeping them up to date. By making this move, we keep all the forms consistent in the way they look and ease of use for our partners. Thank you.
Is there any questions? Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing. Open a work session on Senate Bill 376.
So, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 376 to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 376 to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Olson, carry the please. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 381.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 381 is the Oregon State Bar Bill. It increases the members on the Board of Governors to 19 members and says that the new member must be an Oregon licensed attorney who maintains a practice outside of the state. It also gives the board the clear authority to establish dates on which professional liability fund contributions must be made and removes fixed timelines for corrections of delinquency. And it clarifies the structure and the duties of the Board of Bar Examiners. Excuse me. This bill is ready to move today, should you choose to do so.
Thank you. Helen Hirschbeibel?
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Helen Hirschbeil. I'm general counsel for the Oregon State Bar, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors to testify in support of this bill. As committee counsel explained, there are three key provisions in this bill that deal with Oregon State Bar governance. The first is adding an out-of-state member of the Oregon State Bar to the Board of Governors. And there are really two reasons for this. One is they're active members of the board, active members of the bar, they pay full bar dues, and they are not represented at all on the Board of Governors. And the second is that the Board of Governors is interested in hearing an out-of-state lawyer perspective on issues that come before the board. The second issue relates to timelines for curing non-payment of the professional liability fund assessment. The Oregon State Bar is unique in the sense that it requires all Oregon lawyers who maintain their primary office for the practice of law, private practice of law in Oregon, to have professional liability coverage. And the professional liability fund is responsible for that coverage. And if lawyers don't pay the assessment, they can be suspended from the practice of law. So the bill gives the bar the authority to set the particular dates of sending out notices for non-payment of the professional liability fund assessment. It takes out the fixed deadlines in the statute and gives the bar the authority to set those deadlines, but does still require that the bar give some reasonable opportunity to cure the default before suspending the lawyer. The third matter that the bill addresses is the Board of Bar Examiners, and there are three issues in there. The first is the Board of Bar Examiners is responsible for the admissions function of the Oregon State Bar. The bill clarifies that fact. It also gives the Supreme Court more flexibility in the appointment of the members of the Board of Bar Examiners. It currently requires that the Supreme Court appoint 12 members to the Board of Bar Examiners, and with fluctuations in the admissions and the number of applicants for admission to the Oregon State Bar, the Supreme Court would like some ability to either increase or decrease the numbers on the Board of Bar Examiners. And the third issue that Senate Bill 381 clarifies or addresses with respect to the Board of Bar Examiners is it makes the records, the admissions records, confidential. And that's consistent with the Oregon Supreme Court rules the way they currently read, and it just puts that into the statute. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Greenlee.
Yes, about how many lawyers are bar members that have their principal office outside the state of Oregon?
About 2,500.
2,500?
Yes.
That's a large number than that, out of 14,000.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Helen, question for you on that same part of the bill, the first part. Not to be rude, but are we confident that there are a lot of that 2,500, that a lot of them want to be on the board of directors of the Oregon State Bar? It seems like that would be a tremendous inconvenience for somebody unless they were in Vancouver.
Chair Barker and Representative Barton, great question. And this this bill actually came at the suggestion of several out-of-state lawyers. They requested that the bar bring this to the legislature through the House of Delegates. The House of Delegates is another sort of policy-making body for the Oregon State Bar, and they passed a resolution saying we would like this. So there is great interest among the out-of-state lawyers.
Can I follow up?
Yes, you may.
Do other states do this?
Chair Barker and Representative Barton, other states do this. There are two states that specifically provide two integrated bars, like the Oregon State Bar, who specifically provide a position on their governing board for out-of-state lawyers. And then there are, I think, 14 other states who have an at-large position where out-of-state lawyers can serve in that role. But it's also open to other members of their bars who are in-state. And we really wanted to get at the out-of-state members specifically, so we wanted to limit it to that.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This public hearing open a work session on Senate Bill 381.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 381 to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 381 to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Greenlee, would you carry that for us, please?
Sorry, is that me?
Yes.
Yep.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 402.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 402 came to you from the Senate with 30 aye votes. This would allow an affiant in a small estate proceeding to open deposit accounts with the decedent's fund for the purpose of paying claims and expenses of the states, and specifies that financial institutions are not liable to any person for the affiant's use of those funds, nor is the institution required to ensure those funds are properly used. You have before you today the proposed A2 amendments, which would allow an affiant approved by the Department of Human Services or the Oregon Health Authority to convey any real or personal property to a third party for valuable consideration prior to the expiration of the period for appointment of personal representative. It also allows liens on the property conveyed by affiant as against the decedent or estate, but not against the heirs or devisee, and it makes conforming changes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. Sure appreciate you hearing this bill so promptly after it passed the Senate without objection, as your counsel said. And I also got to say, sitting in the audience, I greatly admire how quickly this committee moves through bills. So there must have been some vetting among the members before you got here. 402 is a very simple bill. I know you've heard that about several today, but it is true about this one. This deals with small estates, and just to remind the committee, small estates are $200,000 or less in real property and $75,000 or less in personal property. And I would call this the gentleman that hired me. I don't see anybody up here who's been around that long, was Frank Bronner. And we used to have every once in a while a belts and suspenders type bill, and that's what this bill is. Right now, it's unclear in the law whether or not somebody who is closing this estate, again, a small estate, has the ability to come into a bank and open up a account to pay off the final expenses. So we had banks around the state. Some were doing it, some weren't. There were just a lot of uncertainty about the issue. And like many bills that the OBA brings to the legislature, was vetted in our Bank Operations Committee and as well as our Trust Committee. So we would ask that you move the A engrossed bill. We also have with us Mr. Penn from the Oregon Land Title Association. I was going to say he wanted to get on board the train, but since it is the 21st century, I will say he wanted to get on board the spaceship. So as I say, this bill lacks any controversy, I think, and he's brought some good amendments that I believe he has vetted. I know he's vetted with the Oregon State Bar. Several of their groups, several of their sections. I've also talked to Lane Shetterly with the Oregon Law Commission. He is fine with the concepts. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or turn it over to Mr. Penn.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Dale Penn. I'm representing the Oregon Land Title Association and requesting your support on the A2 amendments to Senate Bill 402. The bill or the amendments make two changes. The first relates to small estates in which DHS is a creditor of the decedent and they have a claim against the estate. In this situation, the state has arranged for the appointment of an affiant in the small estate case, and in some cases of this kind, a sale may generate enough funds to pay DHS partially but not completely. In those circumstances, there are no proceeds distributed to the heirs or the devisees. As a result, in some cases, the heirs or devisees are unwilling to sign off on the sale transaction. Under the current statute, their signatures are necessary, along with the signatures of the small estate affiant or affiant. Therefore, if one heir or any one heir or devisees is unwilling to cooperate, DHS faces having to file a full probate with appointment of a personal representative. This can be a costly and lengthy and expensive process. The proposed changes would authorize the affiant in these limited circumstances to be the only necessary signer on the sale to the third party. The second change will conform small estate statutes to the regular probate statutes. According to ORS 114.345, in a regular probate situation, the personal representative is able to sell the estate's real property without interference from creditors of the heirs or devisees. In a small estate proceeding, creditors of the heirs or devisees are currently able to execute their right from such a sale of the estate's real property. And the proposed change in the A2 amendment will make the regular probate rule apply to small estate proceedings. And we appreciate Mr. Martinez allowing us to use Senate Bill 402 for these amendments, and I'm here for any questions.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question to Ms. Martinez. Sorry. On page 2, there's a paragraph there. Can you tell us about that and why it appears redundant to me, but tell me why it's in there and why you think it's necessary, what, if anything, we're changing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, are you referring to lines 23 through 28?
Yes.
Okay. So that is not redundant, I don't believe. I would defer to you, but I believe it also, that's the part where we talk about the liability protection to the institution for opening these accounts and also for allowing the affiant to withdraw the funds. We're not responsible for what he or she is using the funds for or where they go. So it's an addition to what's on page 1, lines 9 through 12.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
So, in what Let's pretend this, that weren't in there. In what circumstance could the bank plausibly be liable for how the affiant used the funds? That's why it struck me as redundant. It just seemed unclear to me why a bank could be liable if that weren't in place.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, as I mentioned earlier, you know, it is a belts and suspenders type legislation, and I think it's just an abundance of caution that we add that language in to make it clear that there is no liability to the financial institution.
I mean, it's not a big deal. Sorry if I may follow.
Oh, please.
So liability only generally attaches with negligence or gross negligence or recklessness, something like that. But I'm trying to think of how a bank could plausibly be negligence by opening an account, be negligent by opening an account pursuant to Section 1C, i.e. that on the first page. Like, theoretically, how could a bank be negligent pursuant to that statute and thus why is that language necessary on the second page?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Barton, I would just state, not an attorney, but certainly we have seen very creative attorneys around the state, around the country, that have found ways to sue not just banks but others. And I would also, you know, point out that you know, lines 27 and 28 is language that talks about removing the funds, withdrawing the funds, and that there's no responsibility for the financial institution to make sure they go to the bills that may exist in the estate.
I may follow. Again, it doesn't trouble me so much is because I don't think this language does anything. Is there any body of law or any authority that suggests that a bank currently is responsible to ensure that the funds of the decedent are paid out and properly applied by the
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barton, we're putting this language into law because right now there is no body of law.
Right.
And we're trying to make sure, make it very clear and cover all the bases in drafting the bill to ensure that if these accounts are opened, that there is some protection to the bank and that the person that's trying to pay off these debts knows they can come in and open up these accounts. We've had examples where folks are unsure or do not want to come in and open accounts because they're not sure they have the ability to do so. So this makes it clear not only to the bank, but also to the individual that's coming in to open up the account.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Martinez, thank you for that. I think your testimony is confirming that, in fact, this language is superfluous. To the extent that banks don't owe a duty of care to make sure the personal representative uses the money properly. And then it just seems odd that we're putting in language limiting liability when no duty of care exists. And if a duty of care does exist, then we're doing something substantive. But it just seems weird. It's not a big deal.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Freeman.
Yes. Ms. Penn and I discussed this issue about the sale of property without the signing of the heirs to it. I wonder, is there anything in this context that says that due diligence should be taken to try and get them to sign these documents? Or just bypass them automatically?
Well, I believe, and I actually have someone in the room who can answer that question probably better than I.
Get them up.
All right. Okay. You can come on.
I'm Cleve Abbey, chair of the Legislative Committee of the Oregon Land Title Association. I think that where we see this kind of situation arise where a affiant is endeavoring to liquidate property to pay claims against the estate, and in these cases, it's one of the claimants at least will be the DHS or Oregon Health Authority. The title company will probably will look in to see who the heirs and devisees are, or heirs or devisees, and would see if who's prepared to sign or not sign, but I do think the way the bill is written, if any one or more of the heirs or devisees declines to sign, the affiant can proceed with the sale and consummate the sale and generate the proceeds, which are used to pay the claims.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I guess just comment on that.
Please.
I talk to many old people in the in my business, and they seem exceptionally proud of the fact that their home is what they're going to be passing on to their kids. Now, I know liens come against those homes based on property tax deferment or on Medicaid expenses and other kinds of things. But I'm worried in this case about the desire of the parent to maintain their wishes after they're dead. And I just wonder how much of this is just to make it easier as a way of settling an estate, or how much is really a part of the necessity to deal with the problem. And I'm just wondering if there are safeguards in the bill. And I haven't had a chance to read it, even though Mr. Penn and I had a chat about it.
Chair Barker and Representative Greenlake, I think the answer to that is that this particular provision only applies when OHA or DHS has arranged to appoint an attorney as the affiant. Most small estates, the DHS and OHA is not in the picture, or the parties have taken steps to initiate the small estate themselves. And in those cases, all of the heirs or devisees will have to sign off. It's only in that limited case where you have the OHA or DHS moving a small estate along so that their claim can be paid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, so, Dale, I didn't ask you this question the other day when we were talking about this thing. Is there a time frame involved in this with the account being opened and then also DHS to be able to submit for payment? Especially when you have the overriders from DHS, you know, finding payment due.
Chair Barkin and Vice Chair Olson, I'm not actually aware of the answer to that, so I'd probably pass that on to Cleve as well.
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, the small estate proceedings in there have a time frame built into them, which is 4 months. So all this would have to be taken care of within that time frame.
Outside of probate, yeah.
Well, there's a probate in the sense that there's a small estate proceeding filed with the probate department. There's no court involvement unless there's a dispute over a claim.
How many cases do you see this probably impacting? I mean, folks out there.
Chairman Barker, Representative Olson, we see quite a few small estate filings. We don't see very many that involve DHS and OHA.
Okay, that's what I was targeting. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you very much, Chair Barker. Co-Chair Olson, my name is Ed Johnston. I'm concerned. This is another way for DHS to commit right robbing forfeiture of people's lands just to pocket for themselves, as we see throughout the state that I've been reporting throughout the state here, the capital, since 1995. It's very disturbing because I'm one of those men. I am not a person. I am a man because I know the difference of Black Law Dictionary that is entitled from the British government to our state, to our residents that are confused, that don't know their rights. As property taxes, as Rep. Greenlake, and we had a conversation on another floor in 2013, all taxes are voluntary. And you guys come out and use the banks and use the sheriffs to come out and put guns to our head to steal our land. Now, I've been fighting in the state right now for my rights, for my firearm rights and for my land rights. Because I will not sign one of your contracts, including medical contracts, that will maybe save my life, because I have severe medical issues that have got worse, as most people know in this building. But it's very disturbing when we have administrative rules, and I'm going to be turning in some evidence on this, as I filed with the Secretary of State under admiralty and privacy law. The one thing is with the banks, so you see, I've had it published, all right? Banks, you know, have no legal jurisdiction, including under the Banking Act of 1933. Under House Resolution 192, lawful Americans were supposed to sign off their water, electricity bills, and utilities. That goes back and proven to 1850, so you're a lawful American. 1884, the courts even stated that, including with Congress administrative rules, which I have emailed most of you over the years. I'm turning part of that in this package today, so that way you all get a copy, you know, so this way you can read the truth. Excuse my breath, because I've only got a certain amount of my lungs left. But it is so different and frustrating that we end up having agencies that you're supposed to protect us, the people, not the banks, not the corporations. And I even have a copy of the actual Constitution stamped by the Queen of England that has been filed with the Vatican, as I have publicly called the Vatican out, the Pope, and said if he doesn't come to Oregon with the trial that they're trying to set me up because I spoke up for the people in Lincoln County, that they literally tried to kill me in jail. This is not a joke. This is real. I'm still fighting it. It's all over YouTube. I have the videos up there, including when they assaulted me and came after me with guns.
Bill's about.
I know. It has everything because it come on my land. All right?
You owe money to Medicaid and you die. And
that's what I'm getting to. That's the whole point.
You need to get to it.
I'm getting to that. Thank you, Chair Barker, not to be rude. But it's listening to the whole story about how people get to where they're at or what's going on in their life. So when I'm writing my contract up for my land, I do not have to incorporate the state into it. The state is a corporation. When you pass administrative rules, by administrative rules under contract law, by Title V, it only affects elected and public servants and church members. It does not affect we the people. That's a driver's license, hunting and fishing. And that's like this contract. When I sign a contract for my assets to go to who they're going to go to, the state is not entitled to a percentage. The state is a corporation, has no legal authority. And that is the frustration, because the only legal authority that the state has is by we the people that gave it to you to protect our rights so we're not raped, robbed, and pillaged by our public servants and the banks. And House Resolution 192 says it. And I will be filing that with your emails and give you other stuff, including the letter I filed with Kate Brown on this and what I filed in the Secretary of State. Okay, because I've been fighting a lot of this issue most of my life for 23 years in this building. Most of you know me, you've seen me, you know what I've been fighting on, and thank God I'm still alive and I'm still here. But the odds keep, when I keep exposing this type of stuff. Remember, I had Senate Bill 917 was a third-party bill in 2009 that would have gave the man or woman, the injured party, not plaintiff, the injured party, or petitioner, the injured party, the right to sue, to claim on a person that was, and I hate using the person, to me that's a double word, to a man or woman, all right, on their rights. Because when you're dead, nobody's standing up for you when you're dead. And when somebody does, people can treat it instead of educating themselves to know why. And so I'm concerned with this bill as another opportunity for the state to squiggle their way through the banks onto people's land. You know, I bought and paid for my land. I don't go through banks. I don't go through credit. I don't need that. All right, and so when you're thinking about passing a bill that is going to take away from your own bloodline, your own grandchildren, which you think that you're leaving them, that if you're going to leave them assets and you think you're going to leave it to them being untouched, think about how you're applying these bills and what's going to even affect you personally and your own bloodline.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Any questions? Because I'm turning this in for record, so you can understand that it is a fact that's been filed with the state attorney general and everybody else.
Move to close the public hearing. Move to a work session on Senate Bill 402.
So, Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments into Senate Bill 402.
Representative Olson moves the dash two amendments into Senate Bill 402. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 402 as amended to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 402 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections?
Yes.
Okay.
Object.
Okay, call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Greenwood?
No.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative Leininger?
Aye.
Representative Post?
Aye.
Representative Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Williamson?
Excused.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Barton, carry, please.
He's excited.
Yeah, I would love to carry this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You just went down the line today.
I know.
You're tagged.
True there.
Any more business come before the committee? Thank you, committee. We are adjourned.
Wow. Wow.